Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work, with over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 30th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
This is the first episode of Season 4 of Dialogues with Creators. I'm so proud of the folks I've been able to interview. Writers, entrepreneurs, educators, performing artists, and so much more. This season, I'm lining up another fantastic array of guests with some surprises, I think. However, the other day I realized I had not interviewed probably the most creative person I know, perhaps because this tends to be focused on the region of Chattanooga and North Georgia. However, this guest did live in this area for a while, and he made a film here, so he counts, even though he has lived in California for many, many years. Knox Marshall is a filmmaker, and he knows filmmaking and every part of it. He's also a friend. Since he's able to speak for himself, I'm not going to talk too much on this podcast, and we're going to hear from him about creativity, film, and his prolific career. Knox Marshall, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you. Thank you, Barbara. It's great to be here. It's great to, anytime I get to chat with you is a pleasure and a blessing.
Oh, me too. I will say that back 7 years ago, I can't believe it's been that far, I was able to go out to Los Angeles and we spent some time together. You took me to the Fox Studios, I believe. Yeah. That's where. Yeah. And we saw the Nakatomi building.
Nakatomi for Die Hard. Yep.
Yes, for Die Hard. So that was always fun. Yeah. And some other great stuff out there. We had a good time.
That was fun.
So you're my farthest away guest. And I want to start by just asking you, what are some projects that you're working on?
Wow. Okay. Well, about a year ago, after several years of kind of prepping the idea and nurturing the notion, a close friend, another filmmaking friend, and we started Imagination Bay Entertainment. And since then, we brought in a couple of other storytelling partners. In fact, we just added a fifth the other day. But we together are looking to create a brand of aspirational, positive entertainment that families can trust. And some of our projects will be faith-based, but most of them will just be things that the family, young adults, little kids can enjoy without any worry about woke content, identity politics, any objectionable content like sex or nudity or et cetera. So within that, we are currently curating about 60 plus different, because there's several of us that have come together. So we're pooling our different properties. So we have over 60 different properties for film and TV in our folders. We're of those, we have prioritized 16 at the moment. And of those, we are actively developing about six or eight. And two, we have development deals for. We have managed to secure development deals. That means that someone has hired us to and is putting in money to develop those shows to pitch to streamers, to networks, to any broadcasters at all for purposes of landing them on the air. And when that happens, we'll be producing those shows, you know, and getting them, you know, the different episodes made. Beyond that, we are prioritizing a couple of independent motion pictures and several live action series and a couple of animated series. So we're busy. If you want specifics, the two shows that we have development deals for, one is titled God's Country. And the pilot was shot in Georgia, in the beautiful rural areas there. Our host is a really engaging fellow with a great personality who basically is the, I don't really know the term for it. Maybe we'll just say curator, caretaker of 4,900 acres in Georgia, a beautiful swath of land. And the idea for the show is very simple. It's a fish out of water story. We get people who are very engrossed in their businesses, in their busyness and so forth, and take them into the wilderness to fish or hunt or otherwise just kind of get back to nature and detach from their smart devices and learn what it means to be on the land and learn a little about, you know, the way things really work. You know, we all go to the grocery store, we pick up, a pound of ground beef, and we don't think about where that comes from. It's a really sweet, simple show, and we intend to go to different parts of the United States to shoot with our host and eventually maybe even out of the country, God willing, if we get a pickup. The other show is called Bulletproof Run, and it is a show intended to shine a light on first responders, firefighters, law enforcement officers, emergency medical specialists, and veterans in small towns across America. We will go to these different places. We're going to have different anchor hosts who have a special relationship with each one of these four different realms. They themselves having some time as veterans, as law enforcement or whatever. And we'll go to these small towns. We will find one particular person who's kind of an unsung hero in this region, who's had an impact on many lives and is at this point in time having some trouble. They've got a crisis of the family. Maybe the child was diagnosed with some illness, or they've got they can't meet their mortgage or something. And we're going to find a way to meet those needs. And we're going to rally the community around them in a way that highlights what they do. So we bring in the local law enforcement and the firefighters, and we have a big kind of community festival where there's competitive events and so forth. It's kind of a mashup. There hasn't been a show like this that's mashing up Extreme Makeover Home Edition with Make-A-Wish, with a show that really just says, you know, let's appreciate and say thank you to our law enforcement, to our police, to our firefighters who are going out every morning, not knowing if they're going to come home. You know, the sacrifices they make, that their families make. We want to remind Americans, you've got heroes on every block, and it wouldn't hurt to show them a little love. So that's called Bulletproof Run. The title comes from the gauntlet aspect of the show. At the end of every show, we'll have the community festival with the competitive events, kind of like American Ninja Warrior, the Marine Corps Mud Run, that sort of thing. I'm running on and on. If you want to interject.
No, I just I wanted people to get a sense of what you do.
Yeah.
And that's a variety there. But like you said, this is very American values kind of oriented.
Yeah.
And that's so refreshing. Unfortunately, too many of us are tied to podcasts and other things and TV that is so politically polarizing, that kind of thing right now. Yeah. And we have lost the sense of that we are people with neighbors and communities and localities, and that's what it's all about. You know, whether you want to talk about the bowling alone phenomenon or any of that. And that's, anything that's saying, get off your phones and stop listening to these people who are trying to make you mad.
Yeah. You know, this guy. And it's funny because once upon a time, what was it, the late 60s, early 70s? It was like, what was it, Dropout? I don't know the slogans, but it was about, you know, there was a big get back to nature, sort of get back to basics sort of thing. And that was associated with a more liberal sort of aspect of ideology. And now it's like, I don't know, we've lost a sense of our humanity in the culture. And Imagination Bay wants to, one, we really want to affirm family as the core strength of any culture, of our culture. We want to create stories where parents and kids are basically supporting one another. Kids respect their parents, and the parents are nurturing their kids and seeking to bring out their best attributes and lead them and parent them in a way that's conscientious and mindful of their potential. If you go to our website, which is imaginationbay.com, Imagination Bay, like a bay of water, you'll see an image, our splash image, which is going to be animated to precede our films and TV shows. And it's a little kid in the crow's nest of a ship. We don't know if it's a pirate ship or just a clipper ship, but he's way up high in this crow's nest with his arms outstretched, screaming, "Yoo-hoo! Woo-hoo!" And in the background, what he's staring at is this beautiful oasis of a tropical island with twin volcanoes and a beautiful sky and a lagoon, the Imagination Bay. And eventually, over time, that image is going to get populated with other ships and maybe dolphins jumping out of the water. But we want to signal to people, when people see this image, we wanted something that would say, okay, we're going to take you somewhere special that will make you feel great. We're not going to bring you down. We're not going to depress you. We're not going to tell you that your future Earth is depleted and destroyed and we're all killing each other for food.
Soil and green.
Yeah, exactly. There's no dystopian nightmares. We actually have a dystopian sort of film that's set about 30 years from now as a sort of Twilight Zone-y what if. But the end of the film and throughout the film's kind of arc, there is hope, increasing hope of how things can change. So it's kind of a cautionary fable. But our stories in general will be hopeful and aspirational, and most of them will be very kind of bright in tone. We got an idea to change that image with like a sailor in a dark coat and a dark night sky and lightning so that parents will know if this film is maybe going to be a little scary or intense for their little ones. So where the motion picture rating system is kind of wonky and not always reliable, we want to help parents kind of guide what they let their kids see, give them a heads up in advance. So we want to be – there are some studios right now that the perception is they betrayed the American family-going audience, and they're slipping things into the content, into their projects that is kind of dismaying and in some cases just reprehensible. So we want to do, we were thinking, how can we do the opposite? So we want to, you know, there's a rating system, but we're going to rate our own stuff as well and give parents a heads up and say, look, this is great if you have little kids. This is great for the whole family. And this might be a little scary, so you might want to leave the little ones, you know, let them watch something else or not take them to the movie at all. But we're not going to do anything that's got, like I mentioned earlier, you're not going to see any films from us that have nudity or sex or anything, you know, like deplorable like that.
Well, let me ask about your, you recently sent me a screenplay or a script.
Pilot?
Yes, a pilot for, I think it was called U.S. 30A. Yes. Yeah. Yes. And is that in production or is that?
No, we are shopping it around and we do have some interest. It's basically an updated version of, it's sort of like a Hardy Boys in North Florida. Along the floor, there's a kind of a burgeoning community there. It's just beautiful. There's a number of different little mini cities around the strip of 30A, which is kind of like their Pacific Coast Highway or A1A on the Atlantic. Mm-hmm. It centers around two young guys, Deke and Bodie. They're sons of a famous detective, kind of like the Hardy Boys. We're not too proud to admit it. You know, still
well, nobody would know that today, though.
Yeah,
I mean, a few people would, but most would not connect that, I'm afraid.
But in the pilot episode, they're hunting for a church. You know, the family. There's little things like we're not knocking people over the head with Christian themes for these shows, but we want to portray a more, really, in our opinion, a more balanced view of the American family. There's a lot of families that go to church. And when was the last time you saw one in a TV series that actually attends church?
Well, that they weren't making a joke of it somehow. The father was listening to the ball game during the sermon or something like that, you know.
Exactly. or they have to be waking up to say amen at the liturgy. You know? So it's a fun show with characters who, you know, there's a lot of broken characters in this area because it's a mystery series. But little by little, there's opportunities for redemption, personal redemption, second chances, forgiveness, restoration. I'm big on themes of restoration in our projects. So there'll be a lot of characters who get a second chance at, you know, living the way they, you know. There's a great quote. I want to say of Simone Weil, it's never too late to be what you might have become.
Right. Yeah. That's good.
And I love that. It's, you know, it was on my wall for a long time. And anyway, that's a theme that'll be in a lot of our films. We have a movie right now that's based on true events about a rescue of American kids from Afghanistan in the final days of our pullout, our military pullout in 2021. It's called Trace 4. And we're in talks with some potential funders for it. Basically, there were a number of extractions of Americans when the administration that was in office and still is in office at the time basically turned their backs on Americans and pretended they weren't there. So other people had to step in. These are a bunch of retired special ops guys that answered the call and went in. And in our case, there is a faith-based element because the guy who leads the mission was a military chaplain. And he's a little past, well, he's well past his prime. He's like 58, 59 for military work. And he's having some issues with his heart and so forth. But he can't say no. So he rounds up his buddies and they go, and it's harrowing. The last third of the movie, they're in these tunnels underground under, you know, trying to get to Hamid Karzai Airport. And it's, you know, they're being tracked by the Taliban and so forth. And it's, yeah.
Okay. So now I'm going to start asking you some questions because I have something to kind of jump off on. Okay. You've just talked about four projects that sound huge to me. And yeah. I write books, but I don't do movies, and movies are a whole different, you know, even just writing a screenplay is a whole different, there's no connection. How do you balance all these things?
That's a good question. It really is like, okay, we have to schedule them out. We're curating all these projects and then we prioritize 16 and then we're actively developing 6 to 8. So they get varying amounts of attention depending on, you know, where they are. Obviously the ones we're getting paid to develop get the, you know, they get a lion's share of time and attention until we've exhausted everything we can do that day for those shows. Then we're like, okay, we have these other pilots that are ready to go. And, you know, who are we not reaching out to that we could be reaching out to? Who do we owe a phone call to? Who owes us a phone call after a meeting? We are constantly looking for those opportunities and networking to reach it. You know, we met with major streamers and some newer streamers and with major studios, NBC Universal. It really, how do you prioritize? You just prioritize. You have to decide, okay, what is the likeliest outcome if we do 1, 2, and 3? And for some of these projects, it's about, well, for all of them, really, a big thing is finding potential financiers, investors. So fortunately, we have some great allies who are working on our behalf in that realm. But we also reach out to others in given the kind of productions we want to make and that we want to be an alternative to for parents and families to some of the other entertainment out there, we are largely reaching out to conservative financiers, people who are ideologically aligned with us.
Sure.
And see the need in the marketplace. And there's some amazing stats that we've uncovered that the streaming market, it's in a weird place right now, but it's going to continue to grow. A few days ago, it was revealed that for the first time, linear broadcasting, which is like the traditional networks mm-hmm. and cameras, they represent less than 50% of viewing for all, at least all Americans, for the mm-hmm. first time in history.
And that, that doesn't surprise me, because I haven't watched network television in years, literally, really.
And I have
no idea what's on it.
And kids barely watch it at all. They're watching YouTube. You know, little kids, there's whole YouTube channels with cartoons, Cocomelon and Bluey and all these Puppy Dog Pals. One of our partners was a producer on Puppy Dog Pals for 4 years. So, but the other one, Paw Patrol, is huge on YouTube. So there's all kinds of markets being created that are, you know, we call them alternative, but they are becoming mainstream very quickly. So we see that as an opportunity, whereas it used to be very difficult to create something and get it on the air. You know, if nothing else, you can create a YouTube channel and broadcasting and you know that. So, but there's different types of online streaming. There's AVOD, which is advertising video on demand, which is like Tubi or Freevee, Pluto TV. Those are all free and they use commercials like traditional networks do. But you can pick and choose what you want to watch. You don't have to be at the whims of their scheduling. You can, if you want to watch the Andy Griffith Show at three in the morning, you can do that. You're going to get some commercials, but it's on demand, right? Then there's a premium video on demand, which is where you're paying. And there's subscription video on demand, which is, you know, like Disney Plus, like Netflix, like Amazon Prime, where you're paying a set amount. And depending on the tier, you're not watching any commercials. So there's a lot of opportunity. Obviously, with some of them, you don't get as much money for your show as others, but
And that's fascinating to talk to you because, not to talk about our ages, Knox, but you went out to California in the 80s.
No, 93.
I'm sorry.
Went to USC Film School in 93. Yep.
Okay. Still, that's 30 years.
30 years.
So let's, you know, I have a whole lot more questions about this because you know so much, but I'd kind of like to go back to your, you know, 1993 or before that. How did you know prior to that, that you wanted to go to film school, that this was what you wanted to do no matter what?
Okay. Well, in the mid 80s, I was studying for the ministry I was a public communications major studying, which was the synthesis of speech and Bible. And I was praying at the time, seeking the Lord, do you want me to be a pastor, an evangelist, or a missionary? I said, where should I concentrate my studies? And one day there was a missions conference, and I grew up in South Florida. So I knew what mosquitoes were like when I was a kid. My legs were pizza because they were bitten up by mosquitoes and I would scratch and they would bleed and it was terrible.
Yeah.
So I was willing to go to the mission field, but I really didn't want to go anywhere where there were mosquitoes. So it was hot. I was done with the heat.
Yeah.
And finally there was some mission conference, and I remember surrendering the Lord. I said, okay, if you want me to go somewhere where there's just mosquitoes the size of golf balls, I'll go. I'll go anywhere because I love you. I had been seeking to love the Lord more. It was something that was kind of impacted on my heart. I'd been reading a lot about loving God. And finally, I came to the place where I realized I love the Lord enough to just completely surrender to any place. And when I did that, I got... I call it a calling. It's very, you know, I can see and hear it now. But God basically said film, and turned me to the direction of film. And I was kind of horrified, because even though I'd love film and I'd made lots of short films and was always into that, yeah. I saw that as a side thing. And I had a lot of people who were supporting me in prayer and even with finances to study the ministry. And I knew I was going to disappoint. And I didn't understand. I didn't surrender to that right away. It took me several days to finally say, okay, I don't understand this, but if that's what you want, I will go and do it. And it took me a few years to kind of understand and look back at my life and realize that all my different kind of explorations creatively in music and art and writing and acting and directing and short films and stuff on stage contributed to kind of a holistic sense of storytelling for film, because all of those crafts come into play, including stagecraft, building sets, all that. Regardless, it was, I believe, God redirecting me with a heart for people. And I still, you know, think, geez, should I be up there preaching somewhere? But God's calling has borne out where, though my path has taken me in different directions and I haven't, you know, I'm not like Steven Spielberg and I'm not making millions, my career has been pretty steady, and he has opened doors up for me in the filmmaking world to build and tell stories. And it seems this late in the game now that maybe God is pulling all this together, because over the time that I have been in Los Angeles, working on screenplays for other producers, many of which have not been made, I've been paid for them. This is the journeyman work of most screenwriters. They get paid to make films that never get made. I think the ratio is something like 1 out of 100 screenplays that studios buy actually get made, and 1 out of 1,000 scripts written ever get made into something. And even fewer of those that get made, very few get a theatrical release, and some get no release at all. They just go into the ether. So it's great.
And I have to ask you at this point, forgive me, is that with those odds, when you go to a movie that's, you know, or you see a movie that's like, this was bad. You wonder, okay, if they chose this out of 1,000, what are the others like?
No, there's a lot of great scripts that don't get made. In fact, there's a thing in Hollywood called the blacklist, and not the show with what's his name, but the blacklist is a thing in Hollywood of great scripts that haven't been made, and you even get nominated to it. I had a script that was nominated to the blacklist that I wrote for another producer, and it's about an Asian gangster, female gangster assassin. So it's kind of a La Femme Nikita in the world of the Asian triad, the Chinese triad mafia in Los Angeles. Anyway, writing, it's hard. It's hard. A lot of the reasons those bad movies get made is because they get developed to death. When Star Wars was made, 1977, Alan Ladd was the head of the studio. George Lucas, you know, got his script, I think, to one person, the assistant to Alan Ladd. That's how it was then. Now, like if you remember when we went into the Fox lot, all those little bungalows are filled with development companies, and each one of those development companies has development people, their interns or semi-executives, story executives, and their whole job is to screen scripts that come in from agents and whoever else. Usually it's agents and managers. And they screen, and there's tiers, there's whole levels before it gets to the top person. And their job, the job of these interns and story execs, is to screen out all the scripts that they think don't cut mustard. And finally only recommend a very small percentage as a potential movies to be produced. Their job is to say no, because the minute someone says yes and it moves up, if that movie eventually gets made at the studio or that development company is spending millions on this project and he loses money, then it's going to come back. Oh, who recommended this in the first place? Oh, you want to very expensive and terrible taste. Goodbye. You know? So it's their job to say no. Now, another reason bad movies get made is, frankly, the illicit side of Hollywood, which I'll just say it very deftly, that there are people doing deals because they're getting favors of a very ugly kind.
Yeah.
And there's people getting ahead because they're willing to compromise their values. Mm-hmm. That happens. That happens.
But yeah. So you went out in 1993.
Yeah.
And you went to USC Film School.
Yeah.
And how long were you there? And then what did you do?
Okay. So I actually did not finish the grad program. I went for about a year and a half. I went for a year and a half. And I had an opportunity with a producer who was the former vice president of Columbia Pictures, who was guest teaching a class. I was in his producing class. And he was vice president of Columbia Pictures before he, you know, before this point, he was the first West Coast vice president of the William Morris Agency, which is a very prestigious talent agency. Mm-hmm. And he had produced some movies that I really respected, like Glengarry Glen Ross. Mm-hmm. He also turned out to be evil, just a very bad guy. But I worked for him for about a year and a half as we were developing and getting ready to produce. And we produced a movie called The Grass Harp, which had everybody in it. It was, Walter Matthau, Sissy Spacek, Jack Lemmon, Roddy McDowall. It was an amazing, every part was a name. From that movie, I made a lot of great contacts, and I was going to go back to USC to finish, but I had some friendly investors in Eastern Tennessee, in Chattanooga, who said, you know, we've been watching you and we believe in you and we're ready to help you make your movies. And so we started a little development company to write some scripts, basically to pay the rent while we wrote scripts, myself and a writing partner, and then shop those around. Very quickly, we had some heat on several scripts. They didn't get made, well, not from by us, but since that, one of them has been made like 30 times on Hallmark. Really sad. Like, Santa Claus needs a wife. And basically, that was the idea. It's like the next Santa Claus in line, you know, it's like a family line. The next one needs a bride.
Yes, I've seen that one several times.
And,
yes.
But before that, before our script, it had never been done.
Okay.
That script went all over Hollywood and it didn't get produced. It didn't get picked up. But within about 4 or 5 years, they started making variations, and then the Santa Claus 2 basically really hit it. Mm-hmm. So anyway, we eventually did produce our first film. It was called All Over Again / we re-released it with a new title and a few cuts called Against Time. And the problem is that about the week or two we started to shoot, about a week or two before we started shooting, Disney announced a movie with almost the identical plot, starring Bruce Willis, and 50 times our budget. We were shooting for less than $1 million and they had a $50 million budget. This was in 2000 with Bruce Willis as the lead, called The Kid was the name of that movie. And what could we do? We were already funded and we were on the ground and we had all these people and we had signed deals. So we had to make the movie, and I knew we were going to get clobbered at a certain point. And that's it. And the movie that we made, honestly, just owning up to it, we had a lot of shortcomings, and partly I was young and we had a very green crew, and we had a 70-year-old lead actor who was a prima donna.
We won't say his name, but
no, we won't. We won't at all. But anyway, the film was, it turned out, yeah, it's tilted. I'll call it mediocre. It's a mediocre film, but it has some sweet moments. But we also got clobbered by the Disney movie, The Kid. So knowing that movie was coming out, it was very hard to get a deal for our film. We did get some good offers. My investors asked me to kind of hold out for bigger offers, and unfortunately, you know, we got the smaller offers, you know, because we waited too long. These films have a shelf life. When you make a movie, make a deal as early as you can. And then, so over time, what's been great is over time, I've gained a reputation as somebody who's a pretty decent writer. So I've written a lot of scripts for producers in the independent realm, especially some for studio people, but it's mostly independent. I've done some animation development as well. But I've learned a lot about contracts, about distribution, about acquisitions, you know, the different aspects of what a studio does, about what the different partners, distributors do, the costs associated with these things, places you can shoot for less money, places where you can have animation done for less, and so forth. We've managed to really do some fun stuff in the last few years that's kind of defied the odds because, you know, of accumulated experience, not just on my part, but the people that I'm partnered with, you know. So the blessing of networking with people and pooling your resources, you can do much more, you know, with the people you cumulatively know. And you can on your own individually. So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's so clear that filmmaking is so collaborative and so community. Well, you know, communal in a sense that I'm not sure people see that. You know, there's the auteur theory of filmmaking and all that kind of thing, you know, the Orson Welles and like, yeah, whatever. But, you know, and realistically, it's extremely collaborative. Just sit in the movie theater and watch all those people that work on it, you know.
Yeah.
And I was going to say, when you mentioned the Grass Harp, that there was a time in my life, you know, people talked about the 6 degrees of separation. And I would say, hey, I know Knox and he knows Sissy Spacek.
Yeah, I actually went house hunting for Sissy Spacek.
Yeah.
So, Jesus Christ.
I'm sure you can tell a lot of stories about people, but we won't do this here.
No. Yeah.
So the thing that, you know, you had this goal. Mm-hmm. A lot of times we hear about, you know, follow your heart, follow your dreams, all that kind of thing. But when I hear you talk, it's like, yeah, follow your heart, follow your calling, follow your dreams, and work your off.
Yeah. No, it's a lot of hard work. And after again, being paid to write a number of scripts for different producers, they'll raise money. And we're even doing, you know, we're raising money for development. But we are focused, very laser focused on production funds. But a lot of producers in Hollywood, they'll raise money from a few people. You know, they'll talk, they'll sing, dance, go to dinner, and they'll raise maybe $50,000, $250,000. And with that, they can hire writers to write scripts because they can't sell the movies to studios or to bigger financiers without a script. So they need that first. So they'll raise a little bit of money to hire writers, and then they'll go out and try to raise money for their films. And usually it's really hard. I mean, we're experiencing that now, but we have some great potential. I mean, we're going to stick to it until it, you know, really pulls through. And I think we're close on one or two projects for independent funding. I mean, you have to, as a writer, and again, most screenwriters in Hollywood are me. They're writing projects that never get made or rarely get made. Well, it's one or two out of 10. And you have to get used to taking those blows because it hits you, you know, psychologically. It's like, ah, I put my heart into this and nobody wants to make the movie. You know, it's not like I'm writing a little, you know, dad gets cancer and the whole family's sad movie. I'm writing, you know, stuff with aliens or mermaids or gladiators or whatever. These are movies that people probably want to see. And yet it's really hard to get the money for anything, you know, in the millions, you know. So to counter that, for us right now, we're actually developing, I hesitate to call it a horror movie because it's for Imagination Bay, but it's a faith-based thriller with some dark themes, but ultimately hope and an injection of real Christianity in this movie. Choices, you know, of faith that we want to shoot in Italy for about $250,000. So that's one of, we have big projects and we have little, but that's our smallest feature project. Like the God's Country, that's, you know, we're looking at a very low budget for those shows. It's a very small crew. It's just a couple of people on camera, you know, three people on camera. So we have little shows like that. And then we have like the 30A, or we have a show that's set in 1774 which is budgeted at about $1.2 million an episode for about 45 to 55 minutes. So we have a range. One thing is flexibility. I'm all over the place here, but what I'm trying to emphasize is, yes, you work your butt off, but you also want to maximize your odds, right? So you want to be flexible with opportunity when it hits. So having some projects that you can shoot quickly and for less, but still at a great quality level. And then having your others that are like your prestige, your gems, you know, they're going to cost more because there are people looking for those projects. So we have such a plethora of wonderful projects right now. We have a big board with 16 of them up there, and then we have all the others in the computer that our interns, you know, are looking at and helping us think about, you know, regularly. But the 16 are all over the map as far as genre and budget, scope, audience demographic. We're developing a very inexpensive animated series called Kai and Scrub, which is based on the Dax Sander books. It's about the youngest brother who loves animals and he goes exploring with his pet sea lion. And it's going to be very simple animation, like I don't even know what to describe it to you for your guests, but very simple, but very colorful. It'll be like a storybook come to life, but it'll be educational. We learn about animals under the water, on land, about tropical plants and trees and stuff like that. And it'll just be silly and fun. Mm-hmm. So that's a very inexpensive show we're developing. So we have things on the whole scale so that, okay, this financier is willing to put up X amount of dollars, but not X amount of dollars, XX, then we'll do the little show, right?
Okay.
But we have three guiding principles. Let's see if I can remember them. All of our projects will have broad market appeal. Mm-hmm. All of them have great franchise potential, creating a franchise, you know, of expanded worlds. And all of them, most of them, not all, most of them have some sort of merchandising opportunity. Mm. So for our family projects and our kid projects, that's easy. For some of the more essence, like the Afghanistan movies, we're not going to be selling guns or shirts that, you know, have, you know, let's go in and bust some heads. We're not going to do that. But but most of our shows have great toy potential and stuff. So,
That's fascinating. I know that in the writing world, the publishing world, they want kind of the same thing in the sense of it has to be, they really want series, you know. Yes. If they want a book that there's, if it's good and people buy it, they want to have a bunch more of them.
We're in binge culture. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I here in the department, what I do, we have students who want to go into film. And of course, a lot of that has shifted to Georgia because of the tax breaks and and things. And the university system and the tech system developed the Georgia Film Academy, and our students go there. I've had over 70 go there over the last few years and get their training. And some are working in the field and doing well. And some, something like one fella is a producer for the PBS station, you know, in Chattanooga. So they're doing various things. Some are doing marketing. But to be honest, some of them, I think they get into it and they realize this is hard. You know, you're going to have to move, you know, you can't live in our little corner and be making a lot of movies. I mean, you know, unless you're going to start your own company or something. And you're going to have to really, you know, now there's a strike on. So some of my graduates are unemployed. down deep, I think they find out, dog, this is hard. You know, this is your life. This is sacrifices you have to make. And you moved out to California. You really didn't have any. Did you have connections out there?
Not really. No. USC was good for that, though. I mean, that's a school where you make questions, and it does help you lead. UCLA, the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, and there's other schools that are great that I recommend, like NC School of the Arts and Savannah College of Art and Design.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it was kind of starting from scratch. It was incredibly scary, but I felt like God wanted me there and he got me in, which was amazing.
Yes, it was. Not because of you, but because of other things.
Yeah, some other things. And I, what's funny is when I got the acceptance letter, I was in Tennessee and I got it. And the letter actually started out, "We're sorry to inform you, blah, 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 blah," you know, for the fall semester. And then it said, "However, we have an opening for you for the January term if you want to come then." And I was like, "Wait a minute, what?" And I was, you know, obviously screaming and elated.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was wonderful. So, and I'll, you know what? I'm going to sing a shout out because he was a wonderful man and still is because he's in heaven. But Pastor Ben Hayden, he was my pastor in Chattanooga. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And when I told him that I'd gotten into USC, he was so proud because we had become close by then. Mm-hmm. And he actually paid, he worked it out so that people could, because USC was expensive in those days, you know, proportionally it was, and I didn't have the money, but he made it a way for people to donate to a fund within his ministry that was designated for me.
Wow.
Tax break. And that's how I paid for the first semester of film school.
Mm-hmm.
So I
did not know that. That's amazing. He was amazing.
We had great talks about his friendship with Riku Browning, who was the original Gilman and the Preacher from the Black Lagoon.
Yeah, he knew everybody.
He knew
everybody. So what would be your advice to young people who want to go into film?
One, figure out why you want to be in film. Do you want to tell stories? If you do, if you're a storyteller, then nothing should stop you. If you really have it in your gut that you just have to tell stories and share stories with people, and you have that burning drive to entertain, what I call the big wow. I've always had the big wow. Yeah. It was always a ham. You know, and you know that. I mean, no explanation needed. But if you have that drive to tell stories or to just blow people away somehow with spectacle, with some kind of invention, then don't let anything stop you. But know that you're going to have to work hard as anybody else, and probably harder, because it's a cliche, but it's true. You know, it's show business. It's not show friend. So there's nobody out here just automatically that's going to look at you once you arrive. Like, I forgot her name off the bus in Bowfingers. She says, "Where do I go to be an actress?" You know?
Oh, yeah. Heather Graham. I love that movie. It's not funny, but it's so funny.
Oh, I laugh from beginning to end. So, and it's, there's a lot of truth in that movie.
Yeah.
So you got to work hard, but read everything you can. There's great books on screenwriting and filmmaking. There's no shortage of great books. And if anybody wants, they can reach out via the info@imaginationbay.com address. And I'll recommend some books. You don't have to leave where you are right away to be a filmmaker. Yet, use your phone. There are movies being made on phones. So they're not great, but there are great lenses and things you can buy. Like one of my partners made a documentary buying add-ons to his iPhone, and this thing looks gorgeous, you know. So you can make short films where you are. The editing programs exist that are free or very, very cheap. So the tools exist. It's very democratic now. I like to tell young filmmakers, the new Hollywood is everywhere.
Yeah.
Because the equipment exists. What lacks is acting talent, storytelling talent, directing talent, and, you know, the production value. So if you are willing to educate yourself and study and watch a lot of how did Tarantino become a great filmmaker. He watched like 50,000 movies before he did a film.
Yeah.
He worked at a video store, but I would say start watch the old movies, because frankly, they made a lot of bad movies in the old days too, but they don't survive. They most of them, you know, are hard to find. The good movies are around. So you can look up great movies, start with the AFI Top 100 and watch those films and educate yourself, become film literate. Get a working vocabulary of visuals, of style, of the evolution of films. You know, the first time somebody did a jump cut in a movie, audiences were, blah, what is that? The first time a train came at audiences, they ran out of the theater, you know? And we have evolved our collective consciousness of what works in editorial. There used to be some rules you didn't break in editorial about like jumping across the we have like we call a 180 where you direct from and you don't edit. Anyway, that's been broken. So the rules can be broken, but you got to learn what the rules are, and you need to educate yourself, watch as many movies as you can, read scripts. There are great resources online for scripts, pilots, features. Learn how to write. Writing has changed. So that the task of screenwriting, you're a novelist and I've enjoyed your novels. I write novels as well for Dax Xander, but the task for screenwriting is almost the inverse. You have to tell as much story with as little as possible. And nobody in Hollywood likes to read. So that's something you have to get over. You want to express all this wonderful stuff on the page, but nobody wants to read it. Right. They like pages that are really white with just, you know, minimal description and dialogue. That's hard. It's hard to get to that place, but it's doable. So my advice to any young people wanting to get into film, the new Hollywood is everywhere. You can start where you are. Start. Don't feel like you have to get to a place where you can then start, because you'll never get anything done.
That's interesting.
Big mistakes. I've made a ton of mistakes. And get friends who are like-minded to work with you. There's strength and productivity in numbers, and you can mutually encourage each other in a way that probably you can't on your own. So
the name of this podcast is Dialogues with Creators, and I don't ever really, well, occasionally we talk about what exactly is creativity. I'm more interested in talking to creative people and then having them talk about their process. But you know, if I ask you, you know, for you, what is creativity? How do you picture that in your head and that kind of thing?
The high school I went to had a course in, I guess, I don't know, it was value, what you'd call it, values or just principles of life. And one of them was creativity. And the way it was defined for me then, which I thought was weird at the time, but quickly kind of embraced it, was problem solving. Creativity is problem solving. And how I've come to define that is, I have a problem that there's a story inside me that other people would benefit from, that emotionally they would get a blessing, or, you know, they would laugh, or they would cry. They would feel something. How do I get that story? Creativity is bringing that story out. An artist creates something that's inside of them. The problem is expressing it and figuring out how to express it, so that other people, it's communicated, right? And received in the way they intend. And one way you were a huge blessing to me was impacting me with the idea when I was younger,
me too.
That communication is not just about expressing what's on your mind, but making sure that the audience is getting it as close to what you intend. That mutual interaction is real and vital and alive. And that's true of any art. So my creative process, for me, creativity is, you know, I dream of something, I think of something, I cook it in my head and my heart. And the minute I start really feeling something, then I know there's something special there. For me, especially movies, but any good story is about emotions.
Yeah.
If you're not feeling something, if the audience, the reader is not feeling something, then the artist has failed. Mm-hmm. There is something either lacking in the craft or in the story itself, in the themes that are expressed. Theme is very important to me. I love theme parks, right? That kind of goes hand in glove. But for me, a great story should have at least one big theme that's clearly expressed, and sometimes several sub-themes. And the theme is like, for me, it's like the clothesline on which you hang everything else, plot, character, etc. So if the theme is hope, if the theme is grief, if the theme is redemption, then everything enhances that theme. So when the audience leaves the theater or finishes the book, they feel and get an impression of that theme as being heady and important and potent to life, to their life.
Yeah.
Something they should appreciate more.
Yeah. I think the thing that a lot of people struggle with is that emotion that they want to tell a story, but they get too wrapped up in themselves, not in what they want to express and not what the audience is going to feel, you know, which is why people would want to read it in the first place. You know, they don't want to read it just because they want to sit there looking at words on a page. They want to feel something when it's over with, you know.
They want to be transported. Thoreau said most men live lives of quiet desperation.
Yeah.
So movies and theme parks and roller coasters, right, are about taking us outside of our norms of mundanity or mundane. I'm a writer. I can't pronounce mundanity. The norms of our mundane life. So when you go to a movie, and for me, this is what determines a hit, if enough people see it on the opening weekend so it can sustain. If you laugh more than you laugh in everyday life in those 90 minutes to 2 hours, 3 hours, if you cry more than you cry day to day, if you are exhilarated, if you have thrills, a sense of exhilaration and thrills and gasping, you know, tingling excitement that most people don't experience that day to day. It's also, again, why we go on a roller coaster or some sort of thrill ride or a theme park ride, because we're experiencing something with multiple senses that elevates our sense of feeling. So if a movie, like a horror movie, okay, scares you again, but it's safe. So you're scared, you're scared, and then you come in the theater, oh, I lived. Yay. It's the same thing in the roller coaster, right? You're scared, but there's a trust that you know, and it happens once in a while, the thing isn't going to malfunction and you're not going to die. You get off the ride and you're still alive. If a movie can hit several emotions in the course of its story repeatedly, like Forrest Gump, right?
Yeah.
We're crying. And then there's a few times where he almost gets killed, you know, and we're screaming and terrified. A movie like that becomes a huge box office success. So a number of our films kind of blend. They have those different aspects. Some are just comedy. Some are just, you know, whatever.
Yeah. It's interesting because the last movie I saw was Oppenheimer, and it's long.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, but there were those moments. Of course, when you see the bomb, there's a great deal of awe. On dread. And then when he's imagining what the bomb is going to do in his brain, you're feeling horror, you know, and other emotions. And then at the end, when the tables turn and everything, you're like, you know, so even though it's a 3 hour, very deep, very Nolan going all over the place movie, not as bad as that last one, Tenet. Tenet was, came out during the pandemic, and I was the only human being in this theater. I was going to go to a movie. I didn't care. And I was there, and It was brilliant, but I still don't know what it was about. Yeah. But, you know, even though Alvin Ivor was all that and so heady and, you know, historical and everything, it did have those really strong emotional things. It wasn't a documentary of just da-da-da-da-da, this happened, you know. And yeah. A lot of that had to do with the editing, I think, and the flashbacky stuff. You know, yeah. I know there's another word for that, but no. the constant shifts yeah. in time frame. You know,
the non-linear. I think.
Yeah, extremely non-linear. Okay, yeah. What year are we in now? Because there's five or six different time frames in the thing, yeah. And you're like, yeah. You know, are we in the 30s? Are we in the 40s? Are we in the 50s? Are we in the 60s? Yeah. Oh, where are we? Okay. We've been on here a long time, and I have so appreciated Knox. I have one other question, though, to bring the to kind of wrap this up. And you're a strong believer, and you've talked about how this is, you know, informed that your career and how important it is to you. But you know. So many people who are believers, Christian believers, and talk about film, just, you know, the first thing you say is, Christian movies stink.
Oh, they do, typically. Yeah.
And so, you know, why do they stink and what can we do about it? Or is there an answer? Is it yeah. going to, are they stinky because they have to be?
Send money to Imagination Bay. We'll take care of it.
Okay. Okay. There you go. You everybody hear that?
We there are people addressing this. Finally, it's taken time, but a number of filmmakers in Hollywood and then others that are greener and newer have taken the bull by the horns and decided, okay, we're gonna tell better stories, and yeah. we're going to sign better people who are good at these different crafts. To make sure that the film looks, if you go see Sound of Freedom, which is not an overtly Christian movie, it's really not a Christian movie. It's just a story about human trafficking.
Yeah, but I've seen it. Mm-hmm.
And it's beautifully shot.
Yeah, it is. He's
a fantastic cinematographer. They had a great crew in, you know, in Latin America, and they had great actors. Bill Camp, who's one of my favorite actors, period, mm-hmm. Plays the second banana in that movie. And, they just assembled a team and direct, you know, and basically designated it for purposes that were redemptive. And it's not overtly Christian, but there are other movies like Jesus Revolution was pretty good. It didn't blow me away, but I was moved and I was impressed with the production value, and Kelsey Grammer's great in it. But the other guy, the main guy that plays the guy who becomes the priest,
Lonnie Frisbee.
No, like, how long is no. the other
Greg Laurie,
the guy who plays Greg Laurie, did a fine yeah. job, and the girl, his love interest. So it's going to be hit and miss. It's going to be like, you know, let's find great stories to tell, but let's be very judicious. It's like a lot of Christian movies in our, it's not on our mission statement on our website, but one of the things we talk to investors about is Imagination Bay is not going to do domestic dramas. In other words, movies that you can see on Hallmark, probably, where it's just a simple love story or somebody gets cancer and they recover, or it's, you know, there's a divorce pending and then they reconcile. Okay, these are great themes and they're worthy of storytelling, but you can catch that ad infinitum on free television. We're going to give you, if we're telling, okay, so we have a movie we're developing, a faith-based movie based on an obscure book of the Old Testament. I don't want to mention which one because I don't know anyone still, but we're going to do it essentially as kind of a cross between Singing in the Rain and High School Musical, mm-hmm. With a very young cast and very worthy themes. And it's faith-based, but it's actually kind of leaning Jewish in its themes and the story. And it's the story we draw from. In fact, the characters that we're going to be using are Jewish because we start with a Jewish funeral. And so we're going to have, it's going to be really bright and fun and kids, a very young cast jumping up and down and singing and dancing. Mm-hmm. and kind of impressionistic, but it will embrace great values from a fantastic story in the Old Testament. We have an animated movie based on the Book of Creation. If you notice, people keep making movies about Moses and David, and they forget almost all the other characters in the Bible. Chosen's done a great job. That's what I would hold up as.
Okay. I was going to ask you about The Chosen because I love it. I think, you know, it's done such a good job with the emotional side of it, too, because you take those and you're like,
ugh. Yeah, I think I've seen every episode of The Chosen 3 times, some of them more. That one where Jesus, I can't even say it without choking up, when Mary Magdalene, when he calls her by name, you know, it's just, you know, and what I'm excited about. I'm looking forward to that last episode. I guess it'll be the last episode of the series where they're in the garden and Jesus says, Mary.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. I'm just going to be a hot mess. But yeah, they're doing it right. Dallas and those people, they're doing it right. They, you know, those shows are not being made cheaply, but they're not being made exorbitantly. If Hollywood made The Chosen, they'd spend 10 times as much and it would be awful.
Yeah.
I've watched a number of their podcasts where he and his writers break down the stories and the beats and think about the season because you want something in episode 1 to impact in episode 8 or whatever. And they really care. So people get into Christian film, one, because they think we need better Christian movies. Great. But you got to care about storytelling.
Yeah.
So if you don't care about storytelling, please don't make a Christian movie. If you can't, you know, if you want to make a movie set in, you know, 1600 BC or something, please don't try to make it for 75 cents. You know, go to Morocco, go to Jordan, go to Israel, go somewhere where it kind of looks authentic and find people that you can share your passion, you know, and get the money you need to make it right so that it doesn't look like a little cheap thing.
Yeah.
We have a number of faith-based films that we want to make, and they have interesting themes. There's other people doing it too.
Uh-huh.
And I'm really excited for them. And of course, I love what Dallas is doing with The Chosen and excited for whatever he does next. I heard Terrence Malick. I know Terrence Malick is making a movie about Peter and Jesus. Yeah.
Okay.
Which really excited learning about that today. And I love Terrence Malick.
His movie about the German fella and the farmer who didn't want to serve in the Nazi army. Have you seen that one? It's like A Quiet Life or something like that. I'm not saying it right, but it's very slow, as a Terrence Malick is.
Yeah.
Very slow, but it's beautiful and it's very, very Christian. You know,
I'm a little ashamed and a little embarrassed, but I will seek it out today.
Yeah, and I got the name wrong, but you can.
But I think my favorite of his is The Thin Red Line, which is really, I see it as a meditation on the soul, and it's just, and yeah, he has Christian themes in his films. But he also has just, you know, just bare themes about just God and our place in his creation.
Right.
And I just love that he meditates, because very few filmmakers take the time. They're kind of off-putting. Most people want, you know, they want the sermon drawing. They want the explosions. They want clowns, whatever. But he fathers to take the time to tell stories with deeper thoughts.
Yeah. I really appreciate it, Knox.
Well,
this
pleasure.
Has been fascinating. We could go on for another 3 hours, but I'll let you go since you're in California. And folks, you have heard great wisdom from someone who really knows his craft, knows his business too. And I will say goodbye here unless he has something else to say.
Sure. So we have our interns for fall of 2023. And my partner, Scott, he does the first kind of screening for interns. But if there are people out there that are interested in coming on as interns, they're unpaid positions at present that will change. But for, you know, basically January on, we might be looking for one or two So they could reach out to Knox@ImaginationBay.com or Scott@ImaginationBay.com.
Okay.
There you go.
Super. All right.
Our mission statement's on the website. People can learn a little bit about us there and what we're aspiring to do and working on.
Well, thank you again for spending this time with us. It's great to see you. And
you
best of wishes and luck and all that kind of thing. Although luck has nothing to do with it. And as you said, it's all about the work. So
working prayer. Yes.
Okay.
A lot of prayer.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Take care.